Welcome to Trial Lawyer Review. My name is Jason Lazarus, your host. This podcast is for and about trial lawyers. We'll tell the stories of trial lawyers who go to battle every day in courtrooms throughout the United States for injury victims. And this will be about their stories and about their practices. Hello, everyone. I'm Jason Lazarus, your host for Trial Lawyer Review. Thank you for tuning in today for another episode. Trial Lawyer Review is brought to you by Synergy Settlement Services. In full disclosure, I'm not a professional podcaster. My day job is CEO of Synergy. And Synergy allows trial lawyers to focus on what they do best by handling the difficult issues at settlement, like healthcare lien resolution, Medicare compliance, complex government benefit preservation techniques, and settlement planning and consulting. Joining me on Trial Lawyer Review today is Bruce Stern, an exceedingly successful and leading brain injury catastrophic damages trial lawyer and shareholder with the law firm of Stark & Stark based in New Jersey. And Bruce has a pretty impressive CV, so I'm going to read a little bit of it to you. He is certified by the Supreme Court of New Jersey as a civil trial attorney. He is a member of the firm's accident and personal injury practice. His practice specializes in representing the victims of traumatic brain and spinal cord injuries and wrongful death. In 2004, he began publishing a very impressive traumatic brain injury law blog to share his knowledge and specialization in the area of brain injury law. He is the author of too many articles that would take me a long time to list out if I tried, because I looked at him on his CV, and has been a frequent lecturer teaching other lawyers about some of these complexities that he deals with in his practice through the various trial lawyer associations he's been involved with. He co-authored a book entitled Litigating Brain Injuries, published by Thomson Reuters, and a chapter entitled Brain Injuries, which is included in AAJ's litigation tort case series published by AAJ Press. And he has served as president of the AAJ. He was president from 2019 to 2020 and has been a member of the AAJ since 1982. So a little bit of time spent dedicating his time and efforts to helping the AAJ. He is a member of the AAJ's Executive Committee and National Board of Governors. He's a past chair of the Traumatic Brain Injury Litigation Group and past chair of AAJ's Motor Vehicle Collision Highway and Premises Section. He's also been involved at the state level, involved as the past president of the New Jersey Association for Justice and recipient of that organization's highest award, the Gold Medal for Distinguished Service. In addition to his specialization in brain injury practice, he also handles construction incidents and has obtained a Occupational Safety and Health Administration OSHA certificate through a 30-hour outreach training program for the construction industry. He is certified as a certified civil trial attorney by both the New Jersey Supreme Court and the National Board of Trial Advocacy. He's also a fellow of the International Academy of Trial Lawyers and has been selected a fellow in the International Society of Barristers. Both organizations are highly selective and have rigorous standards for membership. So we are lucky to have him as a guest today. Welcome to Trial Lawyer Review.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here. Looking forward to chatting with you.
Bruce, can you talk a little bit about your law firm and your area of specialization in your practice?
Sure. So our law firm is about somewhere between 85 and 100 attorneys. We're a very diverse practice. The largest practice group is the personal injury department. I think we have somewhere about 30, 35 attorneys that do either personal injury or workers' compensation, all on behalf of the injured party. We also then have a very large construction practice dealing with defective buildings. We have a very large securities practice. We have a large litigation practice, family law practice. estates and trust departments as well.
So in doing some preparation for the podcast, as I always do, I read that you always wanted to be an attorney, but what led you to become a trial lawyer?
Well, first, a step back. Both my dad and my maternal grandfather were attorneys. My grandfather, though, was the county counsel for as long as I remember until he passed away in the late 60s. And when he passed away, my dad then became the county counsel in Mercer County, which is the county for Trenton where I grew up. So I've always been around attorneys, and besides being the county councils, both my dad and grandfather were also Democratic county chairmen. And in the 60s, the governor, the state Democratic chair, and then obviously my grandfather were all from Mercer County, and they used to call me the little prosecutor. And I remember even in the 60s, so I was only, 10 to 14 years old, I was reading books by F. Lee Bailey and Clarence Darrow and all the great trial attorneys. So I think I always wanted to be a trial attorney. My dad was besides being county counsel, was a real estate attorney. And I remember saying to one of his friends who was the senior workers' compensation judge who had asked me, what made you be a lawyer? Did you ever think about not being a lawyer? And I said, I always wanted to be an attorney. And he turned to my dad and he said to me, did your dad ever put pressure on you? And I said, no. And he turned to my dad and he said, is that true? My dad said, yeah, he never made the mistake of not wanting to be an attorney. I never thought about getting into personal injury until I got a clerkship out of law school. And that's really what led me to where I am today.
So I'm just curious, before we came on, we were talking a little bit about your experience, childhood experience growing up sort of around courts. And you were talking a little bit about your experience playing sports inside the courtroom. Can you share that little tidbit?
Yeah. So as the county counsel, my dad was always getting me summer patronage jobs. And so for a couple summers, he got me a job working in the courthouse, which was really, fascinating. One is I got to just sit and watch trials, which was always interesting. But like during lunch and in the summers, and a lot of times there was one big courtroom where the assignment judge was, and he never worked in the summer. They had off. So we used to play wiffle ball in his courtroom during lunch. And depending on where you hit the wiffle ball was either single, double, triple, or home run, or you got out. And also we used to play hide and go seek, so I knew every hiding spot in that courthouse. Unfortunately, they don't use it for civil trials anymore. They built a new courthouse.
Yeah, it seems like you didn't have any choice but to be a lawyer. Right. Growing up with that. So you're widely regarded as one of the leading experts on brain injury litigation in the nation. How did you find that niche?
Well, I had started practicing in 1981. I had worked for two firms when I got hired at Stark & Stark, where I've been since 1988. And the partner who built the firm, Albert Stark, had this hiring philosophy that you hire before you need to fill the position. So prior to coming to Stark & Stark, I had done a lot of products liability work. I tried a lot of cases. But when I got to Stark & Stark, it was like, well, they already had somebody, a partner who did products liability. And so I was initially trying to figure out, like, where's my place in this firm? And then Albert sent me to a brain injury seminar in Phoenix, Arizona. This was, I think, 1990, sponsored by then the National Head Injury Foundation, now the Brain Injury Association of America. And so I went to that conference, a lot of attorneys there. And one of the speakers was Marilyn Spivak, who literally started the the Brain Injury Association, as I said, then the National Head Injury Foundation, in her kitchen in Massachusetts. Her daughter had been seriously injured in a car accident and had sustained a severe traumatic brain injury. And in the 80s, there was really no place for good treatment, for care, advocacy group for people and families who had sustained traumatic brain injuries. And I listened to Marilyn Spivak, and I was just wowed by her. I mean, she was such a motivating speaker. And I came back and became really one of the then foot soldiers in, representing people with brain injuries. And so I went to the conference. And when I got back, I wrote to the two attorneys that were the moderators, Ken Colpan and Simon Fajette, and said, wow, that was a really great program. Next year, could you have somebody speak on whatever the topic of was interesting to me, whatever I was working on? And one time I wrote to them and said, hey, could you have somebody speak on QEEG, quantitative EEG? And I got a call from one of them and said, hey, how would you like to speak? And I'm like, okay. So I called Dr. Frank Duffy, who was a physician at Harvard, who really was one of the leading guys at the time, one of the leading doctors in QEEG, and said, hey, would you speak with me? And I flew up to Boston. I met with him. He agreed to speak with me, so he and I put on an hour presentation at a conference down in somewhere in Florida, I think at the Breakers, if I remember correctly. And then after that, they started inviting me to speak. Also, then when I came back, I was like, wow, there's nobody doing this type of work. And I had, from the presentations, I learned to ask the right questions to clients, found that a lot of clients who were coming in, had been in a car wreck, had a neck injury, and I'd start asking them, what problems do you have? Do you have problems with attention, problems with the concentration? And all of a sudden, I was finding that a lot of my clients did suffer, concussions or mild traumatic brain injuries, and just built the practice.
I think I had read somewhere that you had a an interest or focus in the sciences. Is that something that was what provoked some interest in this area too, with the complicated science that goes behind it?
No, it really wasn't the science, as it just was a very academic, heavy subject. Like I said, that back in the early 90s, nobody knew anything really about concussions and brain injuries. So I started going to lectures. I remember going to lectures at Mount Sinai or at NYU, and I'd be the only lawyer there. And that, whether it was a rehab presentation or a medical presentation, they're looking at me going like, who is this guy and why is he here? But it was a great way to, meet experts and really learn the medicine.
I'm curious, because of my own personal experience, I was involved in an accident. I'm a pretty avid cyclist and was hit by a car while I was cycling.
Yeah, I watched the video.
Yeah, it's not, I hate watching it because having to relive that, I'm sure you've probably heard that from clients you've represented, isn't what you want. You want to put it behind you. But, the accident forces basically broke every bone in my face. I had a 4-3 fracture. And, I know that I had a concussion. I was knocked out, but, lost some of my memories from before. And then, the drugs that they gave me in the ICU kind of knocked out another week after the accident. But, it's funny because there was really no focus at all on whether there was, any type. And clearly there was some kind of mild, brain injury from that, because just from the sheer fact of your brain being bounced around in a deceleration accident like that. But I'm just curious, the damage were such and the coverage was such that I don't think it really mattered, the fact that there may have been this other component of damage But is that very typical? It seems like that still is typical. There's, you know, a focus on really everything but the brain injury sometimes, or it's missed.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, in the 90s and, you know, early 2000s, nobody, you know, really had any appreciation for concussions. But so, you know, normally, you know, when people come in and they've been in really bad traumas, the most important thing, you know, they get triaged and, you know, it's really life and death. They just want to make sure if they're going to release you, you're going to walk out. And if they hospitalize you, they're more concerned with the physical injuries than they are, you know, cognitive problems, you know. And, you know, putting aside cases with moderate or severe, you know, brain injury, you know, if there's long-term problems, you don't really get to appreciate them until, you know, you've been released and then you go home and you go back to work. And then all of a sudden you're like, but I can't multitask anymore. I forget, you know, if something interrupts me, I forget. So, you know, it's when I started doing this, people were like, you know, thinking they were going crazy because all of a sudden, you know, they're 2-3 months post-trauma and they're having problems. You know, they're having problems with attention and concentration. They don't understand why they're having those problems because they weren't being addressed. Like I said, certainly in the 90s and early 2000s, I mean, we're much more sensitive now to the effects of mild brain injury just based on all the sports concussion, you know, literature that's out there. But yet, I saw a presentation from Jeff Manley, who's a neurosurgeon in San Francisco, and even folks who had CT scans, you know, at the hospital in the emergency department, you know, a lot of them, even 3 months out, were no longer even being treated by anybody, you know, and they just go on. And so,
yeah,
that's part of the problem.
I'm curious if there is a case in particular that you've handled that you think is the most important of your career or influential and why. And that may be hard to pick out of a lot of significant cases I think I've seen that you've handled based on your CV.
So I was thinking of that one. And I guess I would put, there's like three different groupings that I would look to. So the first is one really had nothing to do with personal injury, had to do with Megan's Law. And Megan Kayanka was the little girl that had been sexually assaulted and killed by somebody here in New Jersey that ended up becoming Megan's Law and dealing with sex offenders. And when the law passed, they were starting to take older cases and grouping these people in terms of notification of where they could go or where they couldn't go. And so the first cases, they had certain lawyers in the state or the county and then the state who were, quote, Megan approved. I was one of them. My senior partner, Albert Stark, was one of those attorneys. And so because Albert was one of the most senior attorneys in the county and the first case came out of our county, this case was assigned to him. And this is his one oftentimes. He passed it on to one of his associates, but she wasn't Megan's approved. So I said, here, give me the case. I'll handle it. And it was representing a client who been convicted of a sex crime, but it had to do with a prostitute who and buying drugs. It really wasn't. It was not a sex assault case that you would think of. And it was, the issues were really civil law as opposed to criminal law. And so I said, I'll take this on. And I'm like, hey, this is a civil case and it's being defended by the prosecutor's office. They don't know anything about civil law. So I sent out interrogatories. I sent out deposition notices. And then we went before the judge and he denied, quashed everything I wanted to do. And so, you know, I'm like, okay, now what am I supposed to do? I'm pro bono. what's my obligation? So I filed an appeal, and you know, at that time they only used the initials of my clients. They all had initials, and I was my client was AB because it was the first case. And so I remember we go up to the appellate division, and I say, "Hi," I put my appearance on the record. I represent, and I give his name, and the appellate judge is like, "No, no, no, you can't use his real name." And I go, "Like, can't we put the cone of silence down? I mean, we're in the judge's chambers," and she was on the phone with some of the other appellate judges. And then from the appellate division, I had to take the case up to the Supreme Court. And I always remember I was thinking, you know, the court comes out, it's my first time in front of the Supreme Court. And then the Chief Justice comes out, Chief Justice Wilentz. And I'm thinking, oh, he's going to thank me at least. You know, here I am bringing this pro bono case, and there's all these amicus lawyers. And he just gets up and says, "Mr. Stern, we'll hear you." So I start arguing, and I'm not getting any questions. So finally I said, "You know, you didn't ask me, you know, what I think about the law, but if you were to ask me, here's what I would say." And then all these questions started coming in, and ultimately then the case got sent back, and then we went to trial. And I'll never forget, we're up on the fourth floor in the courthouse, and my client's with me, and then the arresting police officer gets off the elevator. This is the officer who had arrested my client and charged him years before, and they embrace. And I'm like, "Well, this is really strange." And then we go and we try the case, and the prosecutor puts on their witnesses, and then the trial judge says to me, "Mr. Stern, it's your turn. Are you going to put your client on the stand?" And I go, "No." And he's like, "You're not going to call your client?" I go, "No, Judge. I call my client. You then say you don't find him credible. That's a basis for, you know, you upholding your decision. Nope, no thanks." At which point, Judge says, "I'll see counsel in chambers," and the prosecutor ended up rolling over and agreeing to my position. So it was one of the cases I was really proud of. It was the first time I ever went to the Supreme Court. It was, you know, did it pro bono. So that's like one case. Another is a bucket kind of our cases I've done as friends of the court, where I've gone to the Supreme Court on behalf of the New Jersey Association for Justice. In New Jersey for a very long time, if you had an economic loss and you were calling an economist to testify, he or she would not be permitted to give the bottom line. So let's assume you have somebody that lost, was going to be out, couldn't work anymore, was going to lost 20 years of work life, and say, you know, was making $100,000 a year. And so you just would multiply 20 times $100,000, and you would say to the jury, you know, the economic loss is $2 million, and then you had to take out taxes. But putting that aside, but you couldn't give the bottom line. So you would say to the expert, you know, "In your opinion, what is the future loss of earning capacity?" And the expert would get up on, go over to the blackboard and write $100,000 times 20.
But just couldn't do the math.
Couldn't do the math. And so that was the law for a long time that I always thought was wrong. And so finally I said, "Well, I'm going to violate this." And, it went up to the, I tried to get rid of it. And then finally I got brought in a case, and we got the Supreme Court in New Jersey to overturn that so that we didn't have to go through that silly exercise. You know, because I'd always go to the jurors and go, "You know, you saw my expert economist put 20 times $100,000, and you're probably figuring out, can he do the math? You know, our court rules don't permit it." So that was a case I was really proud about. I've had a couple in front of the Supreme Court New Jersey Supreme Court dealing with WOPAC collisions and whether photographs would be admissible. You needed an expert to testify. And then the last case I had dealt with, in New Jersey, we have strict liability, and in a products liability case, you know, generally speaking, there's no comparative negligence on the injured person. And I always thought that because there's no meaningful choice in the workplace, I always thought that in non-product liability cases, you know, workers shouldn't be subjected to comparative negligence because, again, there's no meaningful choice. And so I came in as amicus counsel in that case. And although we weren't totally successful in getting the court to bar comparative negligence, we got a really good standard of care charge out of it. So I was really proud about that. And then from my trial work, I guess the two cases I'm proud of about is representing, I'll use immigrants for, I can't think of a better word. I represented an Indian who was riding a bike on the sidewalk who had there are no brakes on the bike. And he literally was riding his bike on the sidewalk. And there's a dispute as to whether he just rode out when he got to the corner, but a bus was making a left-hand turn and the rear wheels of the bus caught my client. And he ended up having one of his legs amputated. And the local police gave my client a ticket for riding a bike with no brakes. And so we went to trial on that case, and we got a verdict in my client's favor. So I was really proud about that. And then the other was a mild traumatic brain injury case where I represented a young Chinese woman who father first came to the United States from China on a visitor's pass and didn't go back. And he then brought his wife and daughter over, and she ended up joining the military, which at the time I didn't even know that you didn't even have to be a United States citizen to be in our military. And I thought, geez, you know, being Chinese, from China, to how could you ever get into our military? But she was I can't remember the rank that she was, something similar to like a sergeant, but she's pretty much working as a clerk. She was involved in an accident, had very little treatment, but was having problems. And we were trying this case in Burlington County, which is a very conservative, pretty much Republican district, but it has a military base. Fort Dix is in the county, and that's where she had been when she got hurt. So on one hand, she was military, which was good. On the other hand, you know, she was Chinese, which was concerning. I mean, I remember, you know, we had some Vietnam vet as a prospective juror, and he got excused. But we went to trial, and we went to trial this was 2016, right during the election, the presidential election. Literally, we took the verdict the Wednesday after the election. And so I tried that to verdict and got a really good verdict, got a $2 million verdict for a woman who, you know, was back working for the Navy. And, but the jury, understood it. And one of the things I'll never forget is, you know, I put her mom on the stand, and her mom didn't speak any English, only spoke Mandarin. And, you know, I said, hey, you know, when your daughter was 20, she left to join the United States Navy. And how did you feel about that? And she said, I was really unhappy. And I said, why? And she said, because I wasn't ready to give up my daughter yet. And I think that regardless of what the language was or what the culture was, people understood a mother not wanting to let her young daughter leave home. And we got we got a wonderful verdict. And I told him to settle the carrier. I called the carrier actually on election day, and I said, you need to settle this case. And they go, well, no, we have two observers in the courtroom. They say it's going well. I said, it's not going well for you. I said, I know when a case is going well, and I know when a case is not going well. And I told her the story. I was in trial, and my adversary was giving a summation, and I was sending a text back to my partner going, I'm getting killed here. So I've been doing this long enough that you know when a case is going well and when it's not going well. So those are kind of, I guess, what I think of as my highlights. I'm sure there were others, but that's what comes to mind.
Well, it's great as a trial lawyer for you to be able to effectuate change in the system, you know, whether it's, you know, the Megan's Law or, you know, changing the way cases are tried in New Jersey, and then also having that ability to impact someone's life after it's been altered by an accident. So to me, that's one of the things I most admire about trial lawyers is what you guys do really is so impactful, whether it's, you know, making changes that help people get the compensation they deserve when they get hurt, or actually getting that compensation for people and representing people when, you know, they've typically experienced something that's probably the most, you know, difficult time in their lives. I know for me, that certainly was the case.
And that's really, you know, we represent, you know, people day to day. And that's certainly gratifying, being able to help them. On the hand, you know, the amicus appellate work that I do, you know, there you're helping everybody. You know, you're changing the law and you're making it fairer. And I don't know, somebody from AAJ, and I think it was Tom Lambert, said, you know, the law's not settled till it's settled well. And it's, you know, something I've always remembered.
I'm curious, are there cases that you're currently working on that you think may have a larger impact on the system like that, or legislatively? I know, you know, I read that you are pretty active in that regard as well. Are there things that you feel like you're working on that may have that kind of impact?
I don't know. I mean, I guess the biggest case right now that comes to mind that I'm working on is a lady who had both her legs amputated in a crash on the Garden State Parkway, where we're suing the New Jersey Turnpike Association, the guardrail manufacturer, and the guardrail installer for defective guardrails and defective and improper installation of those guardrails. And hopefully, you know, we'll have a good outcome there and make some changes in the way these things are installed.
Yeah, I've seen some of those cases in the past, and those can be really, really nasty injuries caused by those guardrails when they're not installed properly or defective designs and whatnot. So it's kind of scary, you know, being someone that travels on the roads, you know, seeing those kinds of cases, because, man, it's it can be devastating, and that sounds like devastating injuries for your client.
Yeah, I mean, what one of my experts kind of analogized, he says, you know, if you take a pencil and you can just snap it, but if you took the pencil and put it this way, and, you know, you can't break the pencil that way, it just, you know, goes through. And that's what happens with these guardrails. You know, if they're not installed properly, they just go right through the door, push the door right on in. It's like a spear.
Yeah, scary right. Stuff. So in again, doing my research for our discussion today, I read that you've developed some new theories of the law, particularly relating to obtaining economic recovery and representing clients with acquired brain injuries. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So my friend Justin Kahn, I don't know if you know Justin, great trial lawyer in South Carolina, he sent me a quote that I think really encapsulates my kind of philosophy in practicing law. It was a quote by Sarah Little Turnbull. And she said, if you don't stretch, you don't know where the edge is. And that's kind of like I said, my philosophy. It's, you know, you got to push the limits. You got to find where, you know, go as far, push the boundaries as far, you know, as you can go. So from an economic standpoint, you know, as I said when I started, you know, you couldn't even put a bottom line on for an economic claim. Still in New Jersey, we can't argue a specific number for, you know, pain and suffering and disability and impairment, which is, makes life difficult when you don't have that kind of anchor that you see in other states. But folks at, you know, Vocational Economics in Louisville, Kentucky, who are experts that I use, and the CEO was, or president was, Tony Gamboa, a vocational economic expert out of Louisville, and he kind of developed this methodology, you know, looking statistically at people who were, if someone's severely injured in a crash and can't work, you know, quantifying the future loss of earning capacity is pretty easy. But he came up with a methodology where people are back to work, working full time. Still, you know, what we know is, regardless of gender, regardless of race, regardless of education, people who have a permanent disability will, over their work life, usually earn less money per year and will have a shortened work life, meaning they will drop out of the workforce earlier than others. And so one of the cases that I had that went up to the New Jersey Appellate Division was a case where I was representing a client involved in a accident. He had a brain injury. He was hit by a truck. He was hit by a car. And then we ended up suing the New Jersey, state of New Jersey, because the guy had gotten a flat tire. The defendant was from South Carolina or Florida, and he had come up to New Jersey, I think, to visit his daughter or something. And anyway, he got a flat tire, and he pulled off to the shoulder in the middle of the, on the center median. And the New Jersey tow truck guy came up and basically told him, "I'm going to call the state police, and I'll tell you when it's safe to go," because they couldn't change his tire on the grass median. The jack kept sinking. And so he said, I need you to drive over to the other, to the right side shoulder, and told the defendant to go when it wasn't safe. And he ended up striking my client, who suffered an orbital fracture and had a mild brain injury. But at the time of the accident, he was like working for one of the financial banks, making $900,000. When we went to trial, I think he was making $1.4 million a year. So, and in New Jersey, when you sue a public entity, in order to get non-economic damages, you have to show that the injury had a significant impact on someone's life. And the trial judge dismissed my non-economic damages because he said, "Hey, your client's back to work. He's working full time. He's making more money," and dismissed the non-economic damages, the pain and suffering, the disability and impairment, the loss of enjoyment of life. So we went to trial only on future loss of earning capacity. And what we argued was that he was going to be forced out of the work life, out of the workforce earlier. That as he got older and he was more fatigued, he would drop out of the workforce. And the jury came back with a verdict of, I think, $3.6 million or something like that. It got partly reduced due to the negligence of the driver who we had settled with earlier. And the defendant, the state of New Jersey, had moved to bar and moved to dismiss our economic claim, I think, three times, before trial, during trial, after we took the verdict. We then went up to the appellate division, and we were successful on the appeal. And so I've been, you know, lecturing and using that methodology for years now.
So switching gears, I'm curious what your experience was like writing a book, which you co-authored with a medical doctor, entitled Litigating Brain Injuries. I took basically 20 years worth of experience and things I'd written and published a book last year called The Art of Settlement. And it was an incredible amount of work. I mean, it was gratifying, and I felt like it was needed in that area. Just curious, what was the process like for you writing that book?
Well, first of all, there was I won't say a draft. Someone else, it was then Thompson West, had hired somebody, another attorney, to write the book, and at least one attorney, and I think it's just one, and she had started writing the book, and I don't know if she just dropped the assignment, they didn't like, so I picked it up, and so that was kind of different, because there's, in a sense, there was an outline. On the other hand, it wasn't very good, and it wasn't anywhere near completion. So, you know, I started writing articles in, I think, late 80s, early 90s. So I took a lot of that material, but, you know, just starting an outline, I mean, it's a lot of work. And then what makes it even more work is every year they ask me to update it, or, you know, write an update, which is a really, that's more difficult than you think than writing the book. Writing the book was much easier than, you know, coming up and going, okay, how can I update this? You know, what can I write now new? You know, and there are always some obviously new stuff. It's never the practice is never stagnant. It's always dynamic and changing, but that's a lot of work. But writing the book wasn't really that difficult. It just was time consuming, but probably more difficult for my typist than for me.
Yeah, similar experience. I mean, you're clearly a thought leader in this area, given all the articles and chapters of different books you've written, in addition to this book that you co-authored. I think you touched on it briefly, but I'm just curious, what is it about writing that you enjoy? Or maybe the better question is, why do you spend your incredibly valuable time on writing?
Well, I always think first it's important to share what we know with others. You know, it drives me nuts when you see some attorneys that won't share their experts, won't share material. I don't believe in that. You know, there's enough work for everybody. And again, it's really for the greater good. So I like writing for others. I like teaching for others. Also, you learn when you write. So one of the early things, the articles, and then I wrote a couple chapters, was on attacking and debunking these low-impact experts that the defense and insurance companies would hire. And they'd hire these, quote, experts to come in and say, well, the forces in this crash were not sufficient to cause brain injury. And so I was getting these reports. And so I started trying to figure out how I could cross-examine them. What was the methodology they were using? Was it valid or invalid? What assumptions were they making, etc.? And I think I actually, you know, authored articles before I ever did it. So I wrote these articles on how to do it, having never done it. I guess it's kind of like Bruce Springsteen writing songs about driving when he didn't even have a license for years and years. And then I remember when I finally went and started cross-examining these experts, and I'm like, wow, what I wrote was true. It was right. I could take these people apart. So you learn when you write, because you start doing the research and, you know, you start learning things. You know, so for instance, one of the things I'm really interested in lecturing about now is, you know, defense says that, you know, in these mild brain injury cases, is everybody gets better. You know, they get better within 3 months, whatever it may be, which is such nonsense. But going to these conferences, you know, Dr. Brent Maisel, he's a neurologist from Galveston, Texas. He's the medical director of the Brain Injury Association of America, and he wrote a paper saying brain injury is a disease, not an event. And what he meant by that was, you know, the defense is always saying, you know, the time that the patient is worse is at the time of the crash, and that time heals all injuries or makes all injuries better. So that if somebody gets worse over time, well, it can't be from the brain injury. It's either malingering or it's psychological, whatever it may be. And so Dr. Maisel wrote this wonderful, wonderful paper. You can find it on the website of the Brain Injury Association of America. It's got a different title, but it's pretty much the same thing. And, you know, I watched Brent lecture, and in his lecture, he talks about how people with traumatic brain injury, whether it's mild, moderate, or severe, but even in mild cases, have increased risk of death. A number of papers showing that even people with mild brain injury have a reduced life expectancy. They have risk for dementia, risk for Parkinson's disease, risk for multiple sclerosis. There's endocrine disorders. There's autonomic dysfunction. So there's lots of disease that is directly related to traumatic brain injury. So I thought, this is really, from an academic or medical, interesting, but how can we use it in litigation? Because you can take someone who has a mild traumatic brain injury, and you know, you can say that the person has an increased risk of dementia, an increased risk of getting Parkinson's disease. But in the state where I practice, and in most states in the United States, in order for a medical expert to give an opinion, that opinion has to be to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, more likely than not. So although there's an increased risk of dementia, for instance, if you ask the doctor, in your opinion, will the person get Parkinson's? Will they get dementia? The doctor can't say, yes, in my opinion, it's more likely than not. So you're not, in most states, like for instance, in Connecticut, even if it's not to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, just the increased risk would be enough to go to the jury with it. But I'm from New Jersey and we can't. So then the question came in, how can we get this admitted into, what can we do with it in a litigation? I was getting interested, and I had, my publisher wanted me to write something for the supplement. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to write on increased risk. Now, conceptually, what can I think of to how to use it? And so I ended up writing, you know, a paper part of my book on how to use increased risk. And now I give lectures on how to use that, you know, increased risk, even in states where you may not be able to get it admitted as such, but when you can't, how else can you get it in? So for instance, you can get the psychological effect. So if your client, you know, says, hey, you know, I'm worried that I'm going to get Alzheimer's, or I'm worried I'm going to get dementia, you can get it in. And then even if you can't get in for that, you know, when you're cross-examining these defense doctors and they say, well, everybody gets better. Well, you can say, if everybody gets better in 3 months, why does somebody like Dr. Tom McAllister, who's one of the top neuropsychiatrists in the United States, call mild traumatic brain injury a public health epidemic, public health problem, if something gets better in 3 months? Why is there so much research on even mild traumatic brain injury if everybody gets better? And if you think everybody gets better, then, you know, here's all this literature. I mean, and it's, you know, tons of literature on Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, increased risk for all these problems. So clearly it's not some benign condition that goes away in, you know, 6 weeks to 3 months. So I learned something by writing. Long answer to a short question.
It's exactly my view, Vin. It's why, you know, also we are very religious about it at Synergy, using that platform to educate trial lawyers and also become that expert, right? When you take the time to do deep dive on some of these topics, like Medicare, for example, or ERISA, you know, they can have some complexity. And when you start doing the research and writing that, you know, it helps everybody else by publishing that, but it also, as you said, sharpens your skill as an expert. And for those of us that actually enjoy writing, I am admittedly one of those people. It's great to be able to get the feedback. Hey, that I read that helped me in some way in my practice. And that's ultimately, you know, the greatest compliment you can pay me is, hey, something you wrote helped me understand this better, or helped me issue spot something in a case, you know, when we were settling it. That's great.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, there'll be times where I've traveled to some state to give a lecture and somebody will come up to me and go like, you probably don't remember me, but you sent me something, you know, 10 years ago and, you know, we got a good outcome as a result. And, you know, that makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah, the idea that, you know, somehow you're better off by not sharing the information because your competitors get it, or like you said, there's really so much work out there. It's kind of a ridiculous narrow view to take to not share when you've got, you know, an incredible team of experts, or you yourself are an expert. You know, why not share that education and try and help everybody to make sure ultimately the industry or the people that you're serving are better off in the end?
Sure. I mean, I got a call this morning from someone from South Jersey, and he's like, I've got this kid who got, you know, had a skull fracture, and he's got these problems, you know, he needs cognitive therapy, you know, who would you refer him to? And I said, well, here's the three experts I would hire, 1, 2, and 3, you know, and that lawyer's going to do a better job. He's going to get a better recovery, and that child's going to be better off. So well worth it.
Absolutely. So switching gears, I wanted to ask you a bit about leadership. You have been an incredible leader amongst trial lawyers in your own state and at the national level. What's driven you in that regard?
Again, it's, you know, you can be an Indian and you can complain, you know, you don't like this or you don't like that, you know, or you can do something about it. And that's, you know, kind of how I've approached it. I want to lead. I want to make change for the better. Want to better represent my clients, better represent injured people, first in New Jersey and then across the country if we can.
So in terms of the trial lawyer associations like AAJ and the state level organizations, why are those so important in your opinion, and what is your involvement with those organizations meant to you in terms of your career and the relationships you've forged? Mm.
Well, I mean, without the, you know, the State Trial Lawyers Association, there would be nobody at the state level preventing the Chamber of Commerce from getting its way and taking people's rights. You know, if it wasn't for AAJ, there'd be no organization really strongly standing there, you know, fighting for the injured and protecting their rights. You know, if it wasn't for AAJ, for instance, during this COVID, you know, the stimulus packages, you know, Mitch McConnell would have given immunity to restaurants and businesses, and they all would have, you know, opened and people would have gotten sick and died. And that's the role, you know, that we play. You know, besides, you know, the educational support that we give to our members. But without the trial lawyer organizations, you know, the chamber would have free run. I mean, the public agrees with our position, but, you know, that doesn't always win the day. But it's been really important to me to, you know, be involved in these trial lawyer, you know, organizations. The closest friends I have now are people that I met through these trial lawyer organizations. You know, they're colleagues from New Jersey. They're colleagues from around the country. You know, I was fortunate that when I joined, you know, Stark & Stark in the late 80s, they were very supportive of what I wanted to do. They were supportive when I wanted to get more involved in our state trial lawyer organization. You know, and then I always tell this story. Two lawyers from West Virginia, Harry Dietzler and Jim Peterson, great trial lawyers from Charleston, West Virginia. We're doing a pack drive for then Atwa, now AHA, and they came up to New Jersey to raise money for the organization. And I don't remember where I ran into them. Probably they came to the office to pitch us for money. And I was talking with them, and I just started getting involved in the brain injury work. I'd gone to one or two conferences, you know, and they said, you know, hey, a friend of ours from West Virginia is starting this traumatic brain injury litigation group through the National Trial Lawyers Organization. You know, you should get involved. So I called the attorney and became a member, and he was there for a year, and then he kind of dropped out. And the next year, the conference was in Arlington, Virginia, in Crystal City. So I went down there, and we're really leaderless, and Ware came in, who said he was been asked to reorganize it, and he said, you know, you're going to be an officer, and you're going to be an officer, and I became an officer. And then next thing I knew, you know, I was getting invited to speak at our national trial lawyer organizations, and then starting to lecture, you know, around the country. And one of the things that really disturbed me is he said, you know, basically I've been appointed for life. And I didn't think anybody in any organization should be appointed for life. And I took him on, you know, and said, hey, and I created the bylaws that we still have that you could only be chair for 1 year. Because I believe everybody ought to have an opportunity. Nobody should be there, you know, forever. So, you know, here we are, you know, 30 years later. And the group's still running strong. We have a great listserv, and, you know, we share information. And we've trained more and more lawyers. You know, one of the things that always disturbed me, why we, you know, I was a member of the, when I told you I started going to these conferences from the Brain Injury Association of America. And as I said, I eventually got invited to speak, and every year I would get invited to speak again. And then in the late 90s, early 2000s, the leadership of BIA changed. The original executive came out of the Kennedy Foundation, so he was used to giving out a lot of money. And he was really interested in training professionals, both doctors and lawyers. And then when he left, a new exec came in, and he came from the disability community. And so he was much more interested in families and survivors than he was professionals. And, you know, we had been running these medical legal conferences for about 11, 12 years, and we'd never make money. Sometimes, if we were lucky, we'd break even. Sometimes if we lost money, some of us would chip in to break even. But and we were supposed to meet in Phoenix on September 13th, 2001. Obviously, that didn't happen. But after that, you know, then the second exec made the decision that it wasn't economically feasible to continue running these seminars, which I thought was such was so short-sighted, because I'm like, yeah, so you lose $10,000. You are training an army of lawyers around the country to help your constituents, you know, the families and the survivors. You know, the economic gain from that is tremendous. And so then I got involved in founding the International Brain Injury Society and the North America Brain Injury Society. And so NABIS in 2002 or 2003, we took over running those medical legal seminars, and we've been running them ever since. NABIS has now come under the umbrella of the International Brain Injury Association, and I'm treasurer of both of those. So.
Yeah, I've been to a few of the NABIS conferences. Pretty incredible collection of experts, both on the medical and legal side. It's interesting. I was talking to another guest on the podcast, and he was talking about the trial lawyer associations almost being, you know, like a massive firm, because like on the listserv, you can go out there and seek assistance, and other lawyers are always willing to help their fellow members of that trial lawyer organization when they've encountered an issue that they don't know what to do with or is outside their area of expertise. And that kind of support is pretty incredible that the trial organizations do. But I think the public doesn't really understand how much protection is secured at the hands of trial organizations, which are, you know, certainly at a disadvantage when you compare to the strength of the chamber that they're typically going up against. So, you know, the importance of it, really, I think most people don't really quite understand it.
Yeah, you're certainly right about that. But you're taking the first point, you know, with our, you know, listservs. So, for instance, on Monday or yesterday, they blend together as we're locked in our homes. You know, one of our members is like, I'm going to trial in New York next month. You know, I'm trying to put together my voir dire questions. And, you know, do you think I should ask about people's jurors' views on COVID, on wearing masks, et cetera? He said, you know, I had seen a lecture where one trial consultant had said, you know, not to do it. And all of a sudden, we had this very wonderful, you know, discussion on the listserv about the strengths and weaknesses of, you know, either approach, do or don't. You know, one of the big litigation topics, you know, is introducing or meeting the Daubert standard for the introduction of diffusion tensor imaging. You know, and so, you know, you have, I think the first brief was written by Steve Smith and Rich Rosen in a case they had in South Carolina that I think ultimately settled. And, you know, we've taken that brief, and the next person that had that issue, they got the brief, and then the next person had the brief. And, you know, here we are, you know, a number of years later, the brief's better. And, you know, everybody's had a hand in updating it and getting more exhibits. And, you know, and then you get some lawyer that doesn't know what he or she is doing. And, you know, they may have come to a lecture and said, oh, I got to get DTI in. And they go and get, have their client undergo a diffusion tensor imaging with just a sophisticated, you know, MRI. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're getting ready to go to trial, and then the defense files a motion to bar their expert. And they're like, oh my God, nobody told me that, you know, this was going to happen. And, you know, so they'll go on the listserv and like, hey, there's this motion file. What do I do? You know, and obviously the last thing, you know, we want is to have an adverse decision, you know. And so I've had times where, you know, I've said to the lawyer, let me call your expert. I'll do the direct for you if you want free. I'll do the introduction. Here's the brief. You know, don't mess this up for everybody else. You know, here it is. And then everybody succeeds as a result. you know, and the public doesn't really understand, you know, what we do. You know, they don't know that, you know, we're the only one with, you know, keeping the finger in the dike, so to speak.
Yeah, very true. I want to ask you something that's kind of near and dear to my heart, which is this idea of empathy. And when we have new people that join our team, I always walk them through our corporate values and the importance of, you know, that. But I also really hammer home this idea of our mission, you know, the importance of the people that we serve, those that are catastrophically injured and, you know, what they've been through. And usually I'll use my accent, even though it's not nearly as severe as many of the folks that we deal with, but just trying to personalize so they understand, you know, in a moment your life is changed by something like this. I'm curious, in terms of the clients that you represent, how do you connect empathetically with what they've been through and then in turn be able to, you know, get that point across to the jury so the jury has a better understanding of what your client's been through?
Well, I think the first thing we can do as a profession is stop using the word case. You know, I have a case. I mean, you can go with a group of lawyers and you'll hear lawyers go, I have a case. I have a case. You know, so now you've totally impersonalized, you know, the client that you're representing, or, you know, the family that you're representing. So that's to me lesson number one. Rodney Ju, who you may know, who's a trial consultant out in Napa, has an exhibit that, you know, it says, you know, we define ourselves by what we love to do. What we love to do is who we are. When someone takes away what we love to do, they take away who we are. And so I try to keep, you know, that in my mind is, you know, it's not a brain injury case. It's not a, you know, leg off case. It's not a damaged baby case. God, you hate that phrase. You know, it's a person whose life has been totally changed by, you know, the negligence or wrongdoing of some person or corporation. And when you approach, you know, a case from that standpoint, then you're able to, you know, understand what the client goes through. I think the other problem, and I try to teach my younger lawyers, is get out of the office. You know, practice of personal injury law is not, putting aside trials, is not an office practice. You know, so I tell younger lawyers, no, if you have some downtime, first of all, go to the courthouse and watch trials. It's one of the things I got, I had the advantage of when I was a clerk, when I was a law clerk, and then also when I first started practicing for a local Trenton firm, you know, I was three blocks from the courthouse. So if I had a free afternoon, I'd just run up to the courthouse and sit in the pews and watch trial lawyers, good lawyers and bad lawyers. Because watching bad lawyers is just as instructive as good lawyers. And then you got to see, you know, back in the 80s, I only practiced in my county. I mean, I never went out of county. So I knew all the doctors who were going to testify, plaintiff and defense. And so you learned how to represent them. But in terms of empathy and representing clients, you've got to go to their homes. You've got to see how they live. You know, one of the things that Rodney Ju has taught me, you know, when we'd make exhibits, and so, you know, you can look at the exhibits, go on your, you know, follow your story. There's the anatomical drawing of your injuries and all of that. And, you know, I think lawyers think cases are about injuries, but they're really about people. And more so than the importance of your damage experts and your medical anatomical drawings is, you know, the photographs of what your client liked to do and now what's their life like now. And so very involved now. And when I create my exhibits, you know, through Rodney's help, You know, we have an exhibit of what did the client, what did the patient, what did the person like to do before? And then Ronnie's always compared to what? Because all personal injury is compared to what? What was their life like before? What is it like compared to now? Everything before and after. And so what's their life like now? And then you always want to have hope. I mean, there's no point in doing this if there's no hope. I mean, you hope that, I mean, the jurors are never going to give you money just to give because your person got hurt. They want to think that their money that they're awarding is going to help, that it's going to make life better for the injured person. And so you've got to, you know, give them hope. And like I said, the best way is to, you know, go to the person's home. I mean, when I learned this lesson, and it took a while, you know, it represented a family whose the husband and the father died a tragic death as a result of a negligently constructed set of steps and ended up getting contracting meningitis, which then led to Stephen Johnson syndrome from the Dilantin, because he got seizures, and then they gave him Dilantin, and then that caught Stephen Johnson, and he basically, literally, he burned to death over 5 months. And, you know, we wanted to get photographs to show just what the loss was. And we went to the client, I went to the client's home, you know, and there were, you know, his closet was still filled. His clothes were still there, you know, 2 years later. And, you know, his daughters got tattoos of, because they ended up, he was cremated and they buried his ashes on their farm, and they'd gotten the longitude and latitudes and they tattooed those on their ankles. And, you know, we found in the house a song that the decedent had written to his wife when he was 16 years old. They had dated and started going out when he was 16, and now they had kids in college. And, you know, there on, you know, the wall was this, you know, song he had written for his then girlfriend, now wife. And, you know, you really got an understanding about how close this family was and what the loss really meant, you know, as opposed to, okay, you know, person died, or, you know, died a tragic death. Here's the economic loss. You know, here's the medical component. And we obviously had to have that and show all this causation. But, you know, what the really case was really about was what was the loss meant to this family. And you can't get that from sitting in your office. Yeah, and then absolutely. Once you understand it, then it's easy to explain it to a jury. Because they can see that you feel it, that you're empathetic, that you understand the emotion. And it becomes pretty easy at that point.
So with the remaining time we have, I wanted to ask you a couple questions about the business aspect of the practice of law. You know, with technology accelerating at the rate it has been in a lot of areas, you know, one area is in cars, and, you know, now we've got cars that have autopilot and, you know, functions that are supposedly making us safer. Do you see that changing the practice of personal injury law, or is it just more potential for people to be harmed when companies put profits ahead of the safety of people?
Well, there's a lot of parts to that question, you know, starting with, you know, your comment, turning to the business. And the business of practicing laws is extremely, you know, important. You know, when I first started practicing, I worked for this Trenton firm, and I was there for 3 or 4 years, and then I went to another firm in Trenton, and they had a huge volume practice, but in neither of those firms was I ever required to bring in clients or bring in business. You know, so for me, then it was just really the practice of law. I wasn't interested at all in the business of law. And then when I joined Stark & Stark, one of my managing partners, you know, stressed that, you know, how important the business side is. If you don't get clients, then, you know, you have a problem. And, you know, at Stark & Stark, we were always taught, you know, get involved in the community. So I was always encouraged, get involved, join an organization that's of interest to you. At the time, before the firm grew to become a more regional firm, we were really, like I said, a local Mercer County firm. And we used to have a zone of desire where we could live, that you had to live. And then literally, my managing partner made a circle, you know, around it. So when I lived in Pennsylvania, I had to move to New Jersey because it was outside the zone. Because and I understood from the business standpoint, because it was, he would say, hey, you know, unless you're a real jerk, you know, your neighbors will come to you. You know, and here I was, if you live in Pennsylvania, you know, we can't do their work. So just the business is important. You know, we always had a saying in our firm, you know, the other thing at Stark & Stark, that Albert Stark, we always had these sayings, you know, one, you know, two heads are better than one, even if one is cabbage. But, you know, we always talked about building chains. And one of his expressions was, put your partner out of work. You know, because the older, more senior attorneys were always in a better position to go out and get business. So if you could put your partner out of work, that forced the partner to go out and find new areas of business. And it, you know, Stark & Stark, you know, the firm has always encouraged entrepreneurship, you know, go out, push the limits, find new business. You know, and I think, you know, I remember we were at a firm retreat years ago, and I'm like, you guys, younger guys, you guys got to get out of just doing auto cases. You know, why is somebody going to come to you when they can come to me, you know, or this partner or that partner that has a better reputation, is probably a better trial lawyer than you, you know, more experience than you? You know, you need to find, you know, your own niche, which is what I ended up doing, not necessarily on my own, because I was sent to that brain injury seminar, you know, 30 some years ago, but I picked up and ran with it. Yeah, and then, you know, you mentioned, you know, automated cars. They tell you that they're safer, but, you know, there's no proof that they're safer because they've never been on the road. And I saw in the paper the other day, you know, Tesla's got all these, you know, crashes due to their automated system. So, you know, whoever knows. But, you know, it's fearful. You know, when I lecture, and when I was president of AHA, you know, and we talk about what we're doing, that's another thing. You know, we're you know, working very hard, because there's going to be legislation dealing with automated cars. I mean, there is an advantage. I mean, you look at the senior population, the disability population that are locked in their homes, that we all can appreciate, you know, living through COVID. You know, but if, you know, you could make a phone call and, you know, a driverless car shows up and then can transport you, you know, all of a sudden these people that are locked in their homes now have freedom and independence that they never had. So, you know, there are huge amounts of advantages, but, you know, the technology companies, they all want immunity. They want, you know, if they're going to be held responsible, which they don't want to be, you know, they want to force you into arbitration where they pick the arbitrators. You know, so AHA has worked really hard to make sure, you know, people's rights aren't taken away. But, you know, I say to the lawyers, I said, you know, client walks into your office and they said they were involved in an automobile crash where defendant ran a red light, T-boned them, they herniated a disc in their neck or their back, and they need a fusion. So I said, how many of you would be excited to take that case? You know, how many of you, would any of you turn that case down? You know, there's silence. And I say, okay, now picture this. Same accident, except the car that went through the red light was an automated driverless vehicle. And now the claim is against Google or, you know, the Ford Motor Company or whatever the technology company is, against Tesla, whatever. And the claim is that the algorithm in the car was defectively designed. And so now you went from this, you know, red light accident to this product liability where you're arguing that the algorithm, you know, which you don't even understand what that is poorly designed, you know, and now all of a sudden, you know, that case that, you know, people might settle, you know, for $300,000-$500,000, some would take less, some would settle more, whatever, is now this huge major product liability case. And now you're not so keen on, you know, taking that case. And that's, you know, certainly frightening. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, AHA has done is, you know, continue to fight against, you know, forced arbitration. And, you know, if they get rid of the filibuster, we'll get rid of forced arbitration. But I think that day's coming, not the filibuster, but getting rid of forced arbitration that, you know, more and more they want to, you know, force you into.
Yeah. I'm curious, because it's a bit of a different model that you practice within. What is it like practicing in an 80 plus lawyer law firm? And also, you've seen it go from a much smaller group to a much larger group. What has it been like being part of that growth as well?
Well, I mean, even when I joined Stark & Stark, I think I was the 32nd or 33rd, you know, attorney, which is certainly much bigger than I had come from. I, you know, started with a firm, I don't know, 15, 16 lawyers. I then left to go to a smaller firm that was run by a father and son. And then there were, I think, three or four associates. And then I went to Stark & Stark. And what makes Stark & Stark unique is not just that we have a large personal injury group. It's, as I said, 30, 40 plus lawyers. But we also have this whole non-personal injury side of the firm, you know, that's do, you know, hourly billers, be it, you know, family law, that some of them, you know, don't even do litigation, you know, and that's sometimes it's strengths and sometimes it's frustrating. I remember being at a retreat. It was one of my first years as a partner, and we're at this retreat down in Naples, Florida. And one of the lawyers, one of the senior lawyers, is talking about the problems of hourly billers and how difficult it is, you know, to have to keep time that our firm, the personal injury lawyers, don't. And he's going on and on, and I had had enough. And I said, you know, you guys don't understand. I said, you know, you go to Thanksgiving dinner and you're enjoying, you know, turkey and you're enjoying being with your family. Me, I'm sitting there running a direct examination across my mind. I'm running a, you know, direct, I'm running across. I'm thinking of an opening. I'm thinking of a closing. You know, it's nonstop. It's always with me. So I don't want to hear about the problems of hourly billers. You know, we have our own pressures as trial attorneys. But, you know, at times it's difficult. You know, certainly as a personal injury attorney, you generate more income than an hourly biller. But, you know, as I got older, you know, I said, hey, it's better being part of a big group, you know. And then, you know, collaboratively, you know, in a big firm, there's so much experience and advice that you can get and give. I mean, one of the hardest things now during, you know, the pandemic is that, you know, I haven't been in the office for a year. And so we have new lawyers, personal injury lawyers that, you know, join the firm. And, you know, I don't get to help train them and they don't get the benefit of my knowledge and my experience. You know, whereas before, you know, at least in my office in Lawrenceville, we have multiple offices. But, you know, I could walk up and down the hallway and say to the younger lawyers, hey, how you doing? What are you working on? Is there anything I can help you with? You know, they could come to me and say, hey, I've got this, you know, deposition tomorrow. I've got this trial. You know, what do you think the theme should be? That type of thing that, it's much, much harder. I mean, like I said, we've lawyers, I don't even know their names because they've joined in the last year. And, you know, on a Zoom call, when you see 30 names, and we use Teams, so you don't even, on Teams, you don't even get to see all the people in the meeting, which is extremely frustrating to me.
Yeah, we use it too. Yeah, that is a frustrating aspect of it. I'm curious, is there anything in particular that you credit with your own success? And is there one tip that you would give to other trial lawyers that has been part of your secret to success as a personal injury practitioner?
I think I've given out some of the ones, you know, that I talk about today that, you know, that I would, you know, recommend, you know, which is obviously know your clients, get out of your office, that it's, you're always learning. So I've been, you know, listening to, you know, one of the nice things about this being at home is you have more time, you know, where, you know, if you had a deposition, you lost an hour driving to the deposition. It never started on time. You drove back, you know, you had to decompress from the deposition. So, you know, you killed a whole day in from a deposition. You know, now, same thing with, you know, court, you know, you have a motion. I drive an hour, sometimes an hour and a half in traffic, stress from the Jersey, you know, traffic. You know, you'd sit in a courtroom, a filled courtroom, waiting to be heard. I mean, you wasted a whole half a day, and then you argue the motion in 10 minutes. We have one county in New Jersey where every other Friday they bring cases in just to, for the lawyers to get yelled at by the presiding judge. You know, why? Where is the case? Why? You know, how? Why do you need more time? And the judge takes the cases alphabetically. So if you got a case where your client's last name starts with S, you're like going to be there the last, probably, you know, at the end of the day. So inefficient. You know, now you have a motion. You get an email from the law clerk or the secretary saying your motion's going to be heard tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Here's the link. 11 o'clock, the on time, maybe a couple of minutes, 5 minutes. You argue for 5-10 minutes. Judge says, I'll send you the decision. Boom, and you're done. So as a result of having more time, I've spent more time on webinars. And, you know, I've, when I say, you know, watch lawyers, I mean, I've been listening to Roger Dodd, who's just incredible, you know, on cross-examination. I've been practicing, you know, for 40 years. I'm learning stuff from watching Roger, you know, the case analysis out of California, you know, they've got access to the whatever the company is that's, you know, Court TV. And so they've got the lawyers and they have people analyzing, and you learn from that. And, you know, I remember I was a commentator on a lawyer in New Jersey who got an $80 million or $60 million verdict, you know, and I'm sitting there and I'm criticizing some of his exhibits, you know, and I'm like, you got a $60 million verdict, it's pretty good. You know, who am I to, you know, criticize his exhibits? But some of them I thought they could be better. And then the poor guy had to, the day the appellate division reversed his verdict, he's doing a presentation with Roger, and Roger's, you know, beating him up over the questions he, you know, the way he asked the questions or what the questions were. But, you know, I don't know which was worse, having to sit through Roger's critique or having a $60 million verdict overturned. But, I, you know, I suspect the latter. But, you know, but you learn. And so, you know, I keep telling these younger, hey, you know, learn this. You never stop learning. You can always improve. You know, these lawyers that don't try to learn is you know, such a mistake, because you can always, you know, you can always get better.
Great advice across multiple aspects, not just professionally, personally as well. Last question, are there any trends you see in dealing with issues that arise at settlement? So I ask that obviously just because, you know, that's what Synergy does, and we deal with a lot of complicated issues. And it seems like for trial lawyers, it's getting more and more complex with Medicare and ERISA and Medicaid and, you know, dealing with all the issues that we call the case after the case. Basically, once you guys get that case settled, there's a lot of little things that have to happen at the end to get that case closed.
Well, so I'm just curious. It's a nightmare. You know, it's why I use your company. You know, I had a case, you know, in the guardrail case that I was talking about, you know, where we wanted to settle with one of the defendant driver, one of the car that cut us off, that had a limited policy. You know, then the question was, well, the client's a Medicaid recipient. And now it's like, well, she wants, you know, she doesn't really want to settle, doesn't think it's enough money, and it wasn't, but it was what it was. And, you know, she's got this Medicaid lien, and we don't know what the lien's, you know, what are we going to have to pay? You know, and, you know, we can't, Medicaid won't negotiate until you settle. And I'm trying to determine whether I should settle, you know, and that was a problem. And, you know, I have another case, that a wrongful death case, you know, and we finally wrapped it up, and there's a Medicare lien, and it's not that big. You know, the client was killed immediately in the crash, so there's not this huge lien, but there's a lien, you know, and I, you know, finally we got the administration papers done, so I'm ready to disperse the money, you know, and then I find out we don't have the final Medicare lien. And I call my paralegal, and I go, well, why don't we have the final Medicare lien number? She says, well, you can't get the final until you settle the case and you're ready to pay. And we were having problems, you know, getting letters of administration because of COVID. You know, there's nobody in the surrogate's office. And so now I have to tell the client it's going to be another 45 days, you know, and she's obviously not happy, and I don't blame her. But, you know, so that's, you know, extremely, extremely frustrating. You know, and then again, you're trying to, if you have a big Medicare lien or Medicaid lien, you're trying to settle the case, and it makes it difficult to settle. And you don't know, you know, because all the client cares about, and rightfully so, is, you know, what's my recovery going to be?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I don't envy lawyers like yourself who are dealing with cases and having to ultimately then deal with those issues, you know, because it does make the practice much more difficult, and clients get frustrated over not having that certainty of what the net proceeds will be, which is, it's admittedly, you know, brass tacks kind of important thing for someone to evaluate when they're deciding whether to settle their case or not. So it's definitely difficult. It's, you know, it's why we do what we do. So, I really want to thank you for your time today. Very much appreciate it. It was a great conversation. If anyone listening wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to reach you?
Well, you certainly could email me. My email address is bstern, B-S-T-E-R-N, at stark, stark.com. Or call me on my cell, 609, or call my own work number, 609-895-7285. We just got a new phone system that's cloud-based, so now makes life pretty easy.
Well, we'll include the contact information in the show notes when the podcast gets put up on the website. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to Trial Lawyer View.
Well, thanks for having me. This was fun.
Thanks for tuning in to Trial Lawyer View. You can find more at triallawyerview.com, and look for more episodes and more content coming in the future.